And we're back. It's the Wednesday edition of Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with colleague Bonnie Berman. There are 17 states which now allow some form of legal medical cannabis. Florida isn't one of them. For decades, there's been a debate to decriminalize cannabis. The expensive war on drugs hasn't slowed down usage, and tax revenues from legal sales could be enormous. Joining me now is journalist and author Doug Fine. His latest book is Too High to Fail, Cannabis and the New Green Economic Revolution. He joins us from Silver City, New Mexico, where he's also a goat herder. Welcome to you, Doug Fine.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
You use only the term cannabis, not marijuana, pot, tea, reefer, ganja, or bud. Why is that?
It's all encompassing. Although humans' social interaction with the cannabis plant, what today we sometimes would dismiss as recreational, but was probably quite spiritual for most of humanity and probably for many cannabis aficionados today, the industrial side strikes me as potentially as big or bigger when it comes to helping bail out America's troubled economy. So, and in addition to potentially providing a source of alternative fuels from foreign oil. So cannabis sort of covers all of those uses instead of just the industrial side or the psychoactive side.
So, Doug, hi. Tell us about this 40-year-old war on drugs, can you?
So it's America's longest war, 10 times longer than World War II. It's cost American taxpayers $1 trillion. It's also cost 10 times more than Ronald Reagan's Star Wars Defense Initiative, all for almost no impact on supply and demand. Journalistically, and I think most Americans realize this, polls show high numbers, like 70% of Americans agree with the statement that the war on drugs is an utter failure. That, incidentally, was candidate Barack Obama's exact words as well. Prior to entering the White House, but up there with segregation, DDT, bad policies that a great country has implemented and has gotten rid of, and this is one that needs to be gotten rid of as soon as possible.
Let's go back in the history of this bias against cannabis. Of course, it's been used for hundreds of years on most every continent, but in the 1930s, things really seemed to focus on this. Remember seeing that spooky movie Reefer Madness and the terror that was implied by it.
The myths and lies that are associated with especially the demonization of cannabis, and the reason why I focused on that is that up to 70% of cartel profits come from cannabis, which was surprising to me to find in my research. I thought it was things like cocaine or meth or heroin. And so we're really talking about America's favorite cash crop, and if the war on cannabis ends, the impact, the positive impact, will be so large for America, which is what my research turned up, that we can separately discuss other issues, such as how do you deal with dangerous, real dangerous drugs, sure, cocaine, but also America's real addiction, prescription pill abuse. But the demonization, right from the start, had a lot of racist overtones. The first head of the Bureau of Narcotics, Harry Anslinger, was fond of telling the New York Times and other publications that the only people that use the plant, the cannabis plant, are Negro jazz singers trying to corrupt a white woman. And the untruths were exposed right at the time. The American Medical Association testified against the federal criminalization of cannabis, passionately arguing in testimony, the head of the AMA at the time, that the medical uses were too important and too great to make such a wrongful decision. And then the very U.S. government in 1942 had to do a quick Orwellian reversal and made, you were talking about Reefer Madness, the propaganda anti-cannabis film, an immediate switch a few years later in 1942 when the Philippines had been captured by the Japanese and America's Navy had no hemp for rope. The Defense Department had to make a very accurate film called Hemp for Victory, and that's a click away on YouTube. So the demonization seems to go back a long way, but actually what's atypical has been these last 80 years. Humanity's relationship with this plant, including in the U.S., Thomas Jefferson pled for early Americans to plant a lot of hemp. The demonization seems like a long time, but really the long-term relationship with the plant is friendly.
I was surprised to find out in the book that just how effective cannabis is as a fabric. It's actually the source word of the word canvas.
Yeah, it's currently used in the door fibers on the sports car, the Dodge Viper. I heard that one, couldn't believe it, called up the company. It is true. But it can't be grown in the U.S. It has to be imported because it's a Schedule I felony, officially regarded as more dangerous than cocaine and meth.
Let me ask you about that. What would it take to actually make it, to reclassify it as a Schedule II or a Schedule III narcotic?
Or not narcotic,
a drug?
That's what I was going to say. I was going to say the action that I advocate in Too High to Fail is a pretty simple one. Congress should immediately remove cannabis from the Controlled Substances Act entirely and allow states to regulate it like alcohol for adult use. So that would make sort of solve the medical conundrum of, oh, how do you decide if somebody's medical use is legitimate or that they just want to use it socially? Of course, we accept health maintenance as a use of wine, and we think, in fact, that it's a great cost cutter for our health care because of the positive components of wine, such as relaxation. But we critique that in cannabis as, oh, just people wanting to get high. Well, that's solved by removing cannabis. In fact, just about every argument that you can make is solved by saying remove cannabis from the Controlled Substances Act. For instance, there's been a lot of news articles lately in cannabis cultivation country, the Emerald Triangle, where I research my book, about illegal black market growers using polluting tactics, whether indoor or outdoor cultivators. The problems are real, and they're different, distinct for indoor and outdoor growing. And when somebody comes to me and says, look at this, I say, yeah, that's another reason to end cannabis prohibition, so that it's just another crop and people don't have to do it in garages, you know, and run off pesticides into the, you know, into the gutters. So it's really, to my mind, win-win.
What's the most common and the best medical uses of cannabis?
They're increasing every day, the studies that are coming out. One of the ones that's most interesting and exciting and promising, and I just sure hope is the real deal. It sure seems like it. There are about 90 known components of cannabis known as cannabinoids, the most famous being THC. Its discovery only in 1964. But now there's now 90-plus known cannabinoids, and one of the ones that's getting a lot of attention in research circles is a non-psychoactive cannabinoid known as CBD, and it has pain-killing analgesic properties. I think it was a Johns Hopkins study recently that confirmed that. It really works well for serious, like post-chemo kind of pain-killing, and some studies are showing that it actually is cytotoxic, can reverse and attack and kill cancerous tumors in certain types of cancers. So we could really talk all day about that. I urge listeners to, you know, do a little research online. There's a sort of a central repository website that I sometimes go to on this. I believe it's called cannabisinternational.org, where a researcher has sort of collected studies in different fields. But you'll find it all over the Internet, the studies confirming cannabis's medical use, which, by the way, humanity's longest existing medical handbook is from China about 3,000 years ago, and it's full of cannabis remedies.
So what are there, if any, health risks?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Let's face it. Anything misused, overused can be a problem. And one of the effects of prohibition, again, here we go, when somebody proposes to me this issue, oh, yes, but isn't cannabis so much stronger now than it used to be, and doesn't that make it more dangerous? And my answer, guess what, is, yeah, let's end the drug war and remove cannabis from the Controlled Substances Act. Then people won't be trying to pack the most powerful possible buds, the flower buds or the psychoactive plant, part of the plants that are smoked today, won't be packing them into tiny backpacks to maximize effect. Rather, the plant will be grown for different uses, such as the cannabinol, the CBD component that we were talking about a moment ago. So certainly one has to be concerned about addiction, just as one has to be concerned about addiction with alcohol, a more dangerous and much more addictive drug than cannabis. But nonetheless, I, who am not much of a drinker, wouldn't want to see alcohol banned. A glass of wine now and then is a lovely thing. So yes, there are dangers from overuse or addiction, and yes, we should address those as real health issues, but certainly not as criminal issues, and certainly not for a relatively harmless plant like cannabis.
Are you familiar with how addictive cannabis is compared to, let's say, cigarettes?
Yeah, you know, there are studies about that. There's just about every question, this is something I should say as a preface, just about every question that you can ask about cannabis, especially on the health and safety side, has studies concluding from all over the world, double blind, the whole thing, concluding a range of things. So when I debate, as I did recently, a former assistant drug czar, we can just go like boxers back and forth. Yes, but the Brown study said this. Oh, yeah, but the Columbia study said this. Oh, yeah, who funded the Columbia study? So we can go back and forth on all of this. Two that come to mind in the general category that you're talking about come in the area of gateway drugs. You know, the old myth that cannabis leads to harder drug use. Let's remember what America's real problems are. Any police officer would tell you they will love to get a cannabis call versus an alcohol call or an OxyContin call. These are our real problems. You know, to the extent that the health reports do cover a broad spectrum on issues, including very well-regarded studies that say that cannabis is not really damaging to your lungs. Actually, lower lung cancer rates in cannabis-only users as opposed to tobacco users or even people that smoke neither. So look that up. That's the Tashkin study, T-A-S-H-K-I-N. So what I say is the conclusions are broad. Let's have tie goes to ending the trillion-year, 40-year-old ineffective drug war that has had no effect on supply and demand. And I don't think 10 years down the line I'm going to be sitting next to a former drug czar who will be arguing, oh, you know what, let's bring back that good old drug war. I don't think that's what's going to happen.
We're speaking with journalist and author Doug Fine. He's joining us by phone from Silver City, New Mexico. We're talking about his book, Too High to Fail, Cannabis and the New Green Economic Revolution. Stay with us, Doug. We're going to take a short break and be back with more.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, that's NPR for the Florida Keys. We're funded by listeners like you and by Kane and Associates, a South Florida intellectual property law firm helping make sense of complex IP, including patent, trademark, copyright, internet, and computer law, on the web at complexip.com.
The Adrian Arsht Center presents a visually and emotionally gripping full-length contemporary ballet, Light, the Holocaust and Humanity Project. Performed by the nationally acclaimed company Ballet Austin, Light shines the spotlight on discrimination and the ultimate triumph of the human spirit. A masterful exposition on one of history's darkest episodes, said the Austin American Statesman. November 3rd and 4th. Information at arshtcenter.org. TEDx Coconut Grove is an independently organized TED event on September 28th at Ransom Everglades School with Emilio Estefan, Joe Greer, James Grippando, James Giler, Thelma Gibson, and a performance by Fusho Daiko. Tickets at TEDxCoconutGrove.org.
George Washington was the father of our country, and he had a hemp plantation. Betsy Ross used it to make the flag that flew above the baby nation. They wrote their declarations on paper from that same hemp fiber press. And I don't know what they smoked when they were taking a break, but I got a pretty good guess. And isn't that righteous? Isn't that good enough? Ain't that the way it ought to be? Isn't that righteous? Isn't that good enough? Righteous is good enough for me. Now it'll calm you down when you're too uptight. It just might make you smile. seed oil in your engine, it'll lubricate the miles. Glaucoma and chemotherapy, they say it smooths out the track. So next time you meet a cancer patient, ask them what they think about that. Isn't that righteous? Isn't that good enough? Ain't that the way it ought to be? Isn't that righteous? And isn't that good enough? Righteous is good enough for me. I don't know why some people get so upset when you say to legalize it. They'd rather build more jails, arrest more people, and spread more crazy lies. It's like talking to a brick wall. You know, they just don't get the facts. I think they ought to try a little of that Betsy Ross. It just might help them relax. And isn't that righteous? Isn't that good enough?
And a little ditty by Seattle musician Jim Page. It's called Isn't That Righteous. Thanks to my colleague Michael Stock for finding that for us. Have you ever heard that before, Doug Fine?
No, that's a great one. It was a totally new one to me. But, you know, in Northern California, in the Emerald Triangle, where I researched Too High to Fail, there are bands, outlaw bands, that do a sort of bluegrassy mountain, you know, locally correct version of the Narco Corridas that are the Mexican drug folk culture uses. And up there, there's a band called the Camo Cowboys that has a very telling song called Flower Police. And it describes the symbiotic relationship between the billion-dollar boondoggle of the drug war, the economy that depends on it and those that are fighting it, and the farmers themselves, in that the enforcement is so, I mean, less than 1%. It's so sparse, but it keeps prices up. And so the farmers in the song, Flower Police, the farmers are saying, okay, come in with your helicopters, Flower Police, and bust one or two people who will, you know, pay their lawyers $30,000 or whatever it is, and we get to keep, you know, send our kids to college because you're keeping prices artificially high. And that's what Mendocino County tried to change, and that's what I researched, their full regulation permitting program for local cannabis farmers in 2011.
It's Topical Currents. We're speaking with Doug Fine. His latest book is Too High to Fail, Cannabis and the New Green Economic Revolution. If you'd like to join in the conversation, the number to call is 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio@WLRN.org. That number again is 800-743-9576. So, Doug Fine, I'd like to ask you why cannabis decriminalization is opposed. You said you followed the money.
Yeah, you know, at this point, what I really believe is that it's bureaucratic inertia. A 40-year-long federal policy, that's a long policy. And it churns up $15 billion of our tax dollars every year, which, of course, is not right in a time of fiscal crisis, even if it were a somewhat effective war, which it's not. We all see the cost in Mexico as well. So, at this point, I think it's just hard to turn off a tap. There's thousands and thousands of people whose jobs is to go catch that 1% or less. I've spoken to former drug agents on all levels, federal, state, local, and they know there's no chance of some success. They don't even think there should be success. The sheriff that I followed up in Northern California said, the sun still rises. There's still a 4th of July with cannabis legal in California and really legal in this county. And so, you know, there's no reason for this drug war. So I basically think it's bureaucratic inertia. When people say, oh, is it this industry or private prisons or pharmaceutical companies? Yeah, you know, maybe. But still, America is waking up and is going to demand an end to cannabis prohibition. And I think people power is going to work in this case.
Why did President Obama change his view?
Boy, I wish, you know how I wish I could answer that question? I wish I could say, well, when we sat down last week and I bent his ear about this, he told me this. So if anybody in the Obama administration is listening, I'd love to take a meeting with Barry. But it's the multi-billion-dollar question. My guess is that he decided to not make it a first-term issue for various reasons, and then when the California prosecutors got out of control and started raiding and stopping American taxpaying local Chamber of Commerce member farmers, including the ones I detailed in the book, it was a little bit too late to do anything. He couldn't sound soft on drugs, he perceived, even though he's wrong, because it's a popular issue, even in the heartland, I should say. Arkansas voters have just put, through signatures, medical cannabis on their ballot for this November. I think the issue spiraled out of control, and he recently, by the way, tried to remedy it. He had Harold and Kumar, the stoner actors, do a little publicity spot before the Democratic convention, and you know, that may have been a sign, but that's not who I am, and that's not why I want cannabis legalized. I want it legalized for the $35 billion that it's going to put back into our economy every year.
Who are some of the notable people you mention in favor of decriminalization?
Oh my gosh, that's the if there's confidence behind the numbers that I researched, some of it comes from the fact that I no longer have to make that sort of apology of, I know this sounds strange, but guess what? You know, everything you've been brainwashed about cannabis is wrong and it should be legalized. List, let me start. Pat Robertson, televangelist. Ronald Reagan, Secretary of State. George Shultz, both passionate that the drug war should end. Pat Robertson on a kind of humanitarian side of, it's wrong to be creating this embarrassing prison population that we have. We have the highest, and totally because of the war on drugs, the highest number of prisoners of any society in history, including hundreds of thousands of nonviolent cannabis users. Let's see, who else? Nobel laureate, conservative free market economist Milton Friedman, late Milton Friedman, spoke in terms of prohibitionary economies that simply create murderous organized crime and obscene profits. So he was coming at it from the economics side. Paul Volcker, former chair of the Fed, perhaps less surprisingly, Jimmy Carter. The UN's Global Commission on Drug Policy, I quoted at length in the book, no diplomatic speech in their report from last year. It was, stop the war on drugs immediately. It's terrible.
Doug, we have an emailer. It is from David in Miami. He wants to know if it's true that hemp can produce 4,000 gallons per acre of ethanol and harvest twice a year.
So the I do have some of those statistics in the book, and I can't remember the number of gallons, but what I can relate to you is the anecdote that first put me... So basically, yes, the gist of that is right. Here's a couple of distinctions. We're not talking about rendering the hemp seed oil. That's nutritive. It's an omega-balanced oil that I put into my health shake every morning. We're talking about fermenting the stalks, fermenting the cellulose in the plant to create an alcohol or an ethanol that can be used as a biofuel. What first put me onto this was a ride that I took in the speaker's van. I was giving a sustainability talk from my last book, and in the van with me was the USDA's biofuels expert, really smart lady. You know, in this 15-minute ride, I learned a whole new number of broad spectrum of biofuels that I hadn't heard of in the past. But I just started researching this book, the book that became Too High to Fail, and I said, when she was done with her list, well, what about industrial cannabis? And she said, oh, yeah, of course, best the rigs. Actually, several times more per acre biofuel yield than corn or soy, which is what's funded today. So I waited three beats to wait for her to say something else, and she didn't. And so I prompted her with a but, and she said, oh, but it's a Schedule I felony. We're not even allowed to talk about it. So that's how I started looking into it. And then I found out that there's a town in Germany. This is a New York Times article, if anybody wants to Google this, New York Times, German town, biofuel, zero unemployment. This town eliminated their 15% unemployment by having the farmers throw all their unusable cellulose into this central facility that now provides all the municipal electricity and power. People can come fill up with the ethanol from it. They become energy independent and wiped out their unemployment. And so it's from there that I say cannabis can be a real part of a regionally based weaning from foreign petroleum for our whole country.
We're speaking with journalist and author Doug Fine. We're talking about his latest book, Too High to Fail, Cannabis and the New Green Economic Revolution. When we come back, we'll take some phone calls, but stay with us.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station. We're funded by listeners like you and by IFC Films, presenting the comedy Sleepwalk with Me, This American Life production, co-written by Ira Glass, starring Mike Birbiglia, now playing at O Cinema and Miami Beach Cinematheque.
Of workshops, guided meditations, chakra clearing, yoga, and healing, ending with a special concert by the Mayapuris. You could be transformed. Details at unityonthebay.org.
Like Topical Currents Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Join the conversation, post a comment, share links, and see what other listeners are saying at facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And we are back. It's the Wednesday edition of Topical Currents. We're joined by journalist and author Doug Fine. We're talking about his latest book, Too High to Fail, Cannabis and the New Green Economic Revolution. Doug, how about a website where people can learn more about you and the book?
Well, thanks for asking. It's pretty easy, dougfine.com. It's got some new dispatches from the Funky Butte Ranch, the solar-powered goat ranch you mentioned at the top of the program, as well as links to a bunch of television interviews I've done recently surrounding this book.
And that's F-I-N-E.
Right.
Let's take a call or two. Fort Lauderdale caller, this is Roxana. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Go ahead.
Hey, Doug, thank you so much for writing the book. You know, I'm Dutch. You know what they say, when you're not Dutch, you're not much. I'm just kidding. Anyway, you know, they say, you know, my question to you, and I always wondered, you know, I mean, just starting to put a seat in and what we already do in Holland for so many years. Have you done any comparative studies of how did Holland did it? How were they able, I mean, even though we're trying to control it right now because of the party people coming in there and just really going out in the town with it, but it's still, it's being sold, you know, it's legal to have an ounce on it. I mean, when you go to Holland, you know, if you know people there, you know, parents work with their kids. The lowest abortion rate in the world. You know, they're very open with it. They're able to educate their kids into what the difference is between hard drugs and soft drugs. That's always the whole thing. Have you done any comparative studies on how did Holland do this?
I haven't done studies, but I can talk to you a little bit about Holland and Portugal. I wish that you had been able to call in a recent debate I did with a drug warrior, because when I mentioned the Netherlands, the talking point on the side of the people paid to say, let's keep this boondoggle going, just another 40 years and $1 trillion of taxpayers' money, and there's you know, it's just like after oil spills when you can find some scientist who gets paid to say that, you know, sea otters caused it. So his take was that the recent conservative-leaning government, I don't know if it was on the federal level or just in the Amsterdam region, has been changing and tweaking back the rules on the sort of area of Amsterdam that's famous for cannabis tourism, and that's true. It was very intentional political, you know, it was political rhetoric, and, you know, nothing's really happening with it. But the Dutch model of how they did it criminalized is not something, you know, whatever works locally is fine. It's really a game where we're pretending that we're not going to enforce it in this one. We're not going to enforce laws if you follow these certain rules in this certain area. It's not the same as legalization. I want things above board so that nobody's ever dealing with the criminal, so that we can put American farmers back to work. Michael Pollan calls American cannabis farmers the best farmers of his generation. This is a crop that Americans should be proud of. On the social and on the industrial, and North Dakota's agricultural commissioner is begging the federal government to stop the nonsense of the drug war, because he sees that Canada, you know, one inch above his state, is industrial cannabis crop is growing in value 20% per year, including those health shakes that I mentioned earlier on the hemp seed oil side. So it's not so much how Holland did it that interests me. It's the numbers that you mentioned, which was basically slight increase in adult use in the period since that, let's call it decriminalization, has happened. No increase or in fact, a decrease because of the open communication and out of the shadows and, you know, when things are not forbidden, the forbidden fruit aspect is taken out of it, a decrease in childhood use and drastic, as you mentioned, drops in all hard drugs and other drugs. Portugal's model has been even more drastic in that regard, in that they've almost eliminated, by legalizing all drugs there, almost eliminated hard drug use. And, you know, I don't know what cannabis use is, but I don't know that we want adult cannabis use to be necessarily lower any more than we want adult wine drinking to be lower, especially if it's done responsibly. A glass of wine a day is considered health maintenance. So I just am careful about talking about the Netherlands example now, because the sort of keep the drug we're going rhetoric now is, oh, look, it's not, even the Dutch government's changing their mind. So I haven't been talking about that one as much lately.
Tell us, give us a little thumbnail, an idea, just a ballpark figure of what it's costing each year to police cannabis usage, and also the court system, and of course the jail and prison system.
Yeah, those last two are almost impossible to quantify, because how do you quantify somebody that it could be a productive computer software designer somewhere and is instead becoming a hardened criminal sitting in a prison cell for growing one of humanity's oldest plants? But on the tax side, to fight the drug war, we pay about $15 billion a year, $9 billion or something for domestic enforcement next year. So don't listen when the drug war says, well, it's not a drug war, it's about education. Highest enforcement budget ever, $9 billion, something in that range. But the most scary part of the enforcement budget for 2013 is the first time introduction in the Defense Authorization Act of the use of drones to fight Americans in the domestic drug war. So that's something we should stop and be very, very, very concerned about. I say this as a patriot, you know. I'm glad we have drones, but not to fight my neighbors. The other side, though, the revenue to be generated when this crop is fully brought above board, that's what I like talking about, because that's what I researched in the book. First of all, California as a state has raised about, the last couple of years, $100 million per year just in tax collection from the cannabis industry, and it's just getting going. It's just a tiny, it's a gray market because of the federal quagmire, the absurd federal ban on cannabis. And so the county, Mendocino, that I researched, brought 100 farmers above ground. That's how many were willing to come above ground bravely, give their real names, become permitted farmers. They got a zip tie, a yellow zip tie, for each of their 99 plants per parcel, paid about $8,500 per season, per farm, in fees and to the county, and in third-party inspection fees for the strict regulations and surrounding the ordinance, the land use ordinance that allowed this, and raised $600,000 for the county, saving 7 deputy sheriff positions that were slated for cut. And when I spoke to the administrator of this zip-tie program in Mendocino County, a sergeant in the sheriff's department, and asked him what he thought, he said it wasn't just the saving of the deputy jobs that was important. The really important thing was the public safety change, because in 26 years on the force, I've never gotten calls like this on domestic violence, on home invasion, because farmers are now able to participate in the society. And they can call us, because we're not going to arrest them for their plants, because we issued them the permit for their plants. So it's having this huge public safety impact, which is obvious. It's obvious. We only know of Al Capone because of prohibition.
Doug, can you tell us about that 9.31 program? Just a brief description of it, so our listeners will know how they did that in Mendocino County.
So it was the Land Use Ordinance 9.31, colloquially called the zip tie program I was just describing.
Okay.
And so the deal was, farmers, it started a few seasons earlier, but I was there for its peak in 2011 when 100 farmers came above board, as I said. And so the county would permit, under strict sustainability and zoning rules, up to 99 plants. So you'd have this, if you're a farmer up there, you have this certificate at the entrance to your farm, and then your plants were zip-tied, and the helicopters that are the summer soundtrack in Northern California, care of taxpayers, would pass you by because you were a legal farm, and it completely worked. It was so successful that it was going to be implemented in surrounding counties. Potentially, it's a model still for locavore farmers nationwide, but it would have been thousands and thousands of farmers generating millions and millions of municipal revenue in Northern California and elsewhere this year, had the feds not come in with machine guns. DEA came in and raided the sort of spokesperson, the poster child for this Hurt the Cartels, Go American Farmers, Sustainable American Farmers Movement. His name is Matt Cohen, and kept him, he and his wife separated for 8 hours in handcuffs with no access to attorneys, chopped down their crop that 3,300 patients were about to get, including a liver cancer patient who says Matt Cohen's crop has kept him alive and doesn't want to buy it from cartels, giving him his appetite back. So your taxpaying dollars are costing lives. Then the U.S. attorney for Northern California, according to the Mendocino County Board of Supervisors, personally threatened members of the Board of Supervisors if they did not shut down this 9.31 zip tie program that had generated revenue, created jobs, helped the environment, and decreased crime.
So where does it stand today? It's been shut down now?
Pretty much. You can still Mendocino already has full legalization for growing 25 plants per parcel, I think it is. And so if you really want to be sure that the county or state is not going to come mess with your farm for a very small amount, very few plants, 25 plants, you can still get those zip ties. But for now, the program is in dormancy, and hopefully federal cannabis prohibition will end soon and it can rev back up. Because you know what? I was just there on this book tour and everyone's growing again, but this time it's for the black market instead of for real patients.
Mm.
And we move along to our callers, Michael in Pompano. Hi. Michael, you're up.
I think it's a waste of money and waste of dollars, the war on drugs, because the only thing the wars they do is create more wars. Violence create more violence. And it's really amazed me that the people don't know that all the monies that are being spent in the different wars, and there's no solution for wars.
How about a comment, Doug Fine?
Well, you know, the Ecclesiastes in the Bible says that there's a time for peace and time for war, so I won't get into it. You know, I yearn for peace in all aspects of the world and in my life, but I won't get into an overall critique of war in general. All I will say is that this war is wrong and needs to end immediately, that the drug peace era will be better for America by far.
And we're going to take another short break on our program. We're speaking with Doug Fine. We're talking about his book, Too High to Fail, Cannabis and the New Green Economic Revolution.
And thank you for joining us today for Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. City Year Miami unites a diverse group of 17 to 24-year-olds for a year of service as tutors, mentors, and role models who make a difference to students and schools. You can learn more online at cityyear.org. City Year, give a year, change the world. The String Fellows of the New World Symphony, America's Orchestral Academy, present a free preseason concert titled Soaring Strings, Saturday, September 15th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets and more information at nws.edu.
Hello, it's Bonnie Berman. Join us for Thursday's Topical Currents when we begin with Miami Herald staff writer Eleanor Brecker. Her main beat is the obituary, profiles of noted departed South Floridians. She also continues to write about a favorite topic, animal issues. And more, Linda Gassenheimer with Chef Hector Morales of Miami Beach's famed Epicure Market and Cafes. They discuss foods for the upcoming Jewish holiday. That's Topical Currents Thursday at 1 o'clock.
And we return our final segment here on Topical Currents with Doug Fine. His book is Too High to Fail, Cannabis and the New Green Economic Revolution. If you want more information, his website is dougfine.com. And we'll take another quick call. This is Jared in Hollywood.
Hey, how you doing, sir?
Good.
I'd like to thank Doug Fine for making both an educated and compelling argument for the legalization and regulation of marijuana. We've talked about some of the positive aspects of the political and economic side of legalizing marijuana, but what I was wondering if he could offer some insight into the political implications of Amendment 64 that's currently on the ballot in Colorado and what that will do to the debate on state versus federal legislation. He also talked about people power and how that can affect change and in federal policy. And I was wondering if Amendment 64 is successfully passed, how much more momentum does he think we need in order to change the federal policy and legislation which affects marijuana?
Should I leap right in?
Sure.
Okay, so good questions. Amendment 64, of course, being the ballot initiative in Colorado, one of three full, what you could call full legalization for adult use of a certain amount of cannabis, three states that are voting on that in November, and it would be the first three states to so pass legislation since the modern drug war began. Colorado, Washington, and Oregon are the three. Now, I'm not an expert, and people can go online at the details on each of them, but I know that no legislation is perfect, but I support all three of those because I think it does, momentum-wise, send a message to the nation that voters in three states are saying, let's end the drug war now. What we want is cannabis out of the Controlled Substances Act. That's what the voters are saying. What don't you understand? And so this is also the route that ended alcohol prohibition. People were surprised how quickly, in the end, alcohol prohibition came about. It seemed like an immovable force. But the same miscues were made by the prohibitionists that are now being made by the drug warriors, and that is going too hard on enforcement on people that are law-abiding and that are basically regular folks, in this case farmers. In alcohol prohibition, it was, instead of going after the Al Capones, it was going into speakeasies in the end when throwing respectable people who just wanted a beer into paddy wagons. Everybody thought that was okay. Like, and so it fired up people against prohibition who generally hadn't cared. And polls are clearly showing this with the drug war, up from 49% supporting a full decriminalization of cannabis a year ago to 56% now, the first time that Americans have polled on that. Where Americans are amazingly united on medical cannabis, 70 to 80% on that. Imagine that, Americans agreeing on an issue like that. Federal government, of course, does not agree. Having it cannabis in Schedule 1 in the Controlled Substances Act officially means that it has no medicinal value at all. The American Medical Association, of course, disagrees. I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball, but it seems like history would say that these state-by-state maneuvers combined with miscues, combined with the truth being on the drug peace side, will win out. But whenever it seems like, I can't find an opponent who isn't paid to oppose me on this issue, I recall something that the executive director of the California branch of NORML, the longtime cannabis legalization activist organization, told me when I said, is it as inevitable as it seems from my research? He said, oh, yeah, it's inevitable. I just don't know if it's next year or in 20 years.
I was struck by a quote that you led off a chapter with, Doug Fine, from none other than Albert Einstein, remarking about the futility of passing laws which can't be enforced.
It was one of the first things he noticed about America. It comes from a journal that he that's been published called First Visit to America, 1921. And he just said, yeah, prohibition is not just stupid, but it's the very passing of unenforceable laws that undermine overall society's respect for law and order.
And we'll take another quick call. This is Sean in Miami. Thanks for your patience, Sean. Hi.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Doug, I was wondering if there's a sobriety test for cannabis, and if there was great awareness of one, would that help the legalization of cannabis in America?
Excellent question. It's one of, like I said, when I'm debating people who want to keep this trillion-dollar America's longest war going, they're always confusing the issue by trying to scare people about children. Oh, the kids are going to walk to kindergarten with joints. But there really actually are intelligent issues we need to be concerned about. I'm not thing that, and as there were with ending alcohol prohibition, incidentally, people didn't know, like, how strong could whiskey be, and how strong can beer be, and who can buy it, and where can you sell it, and those are real issues. The future of sobriety, when people need to be sober, operating a vehicle, piloting a plane, teaching children, running a railroad, whatever it is, when people need to be sober, we need to sort of advance to the next stage. And it's, in fact, why some activists are a little bit angry or uncertain about the Washington Initiative, because it throws in what many people believe is a very random level of THC, the psychoactive component of cannabis, that can be in one's blood if one is going to be tested and considered sober, let's say, at a roadside stop. And nobody knows. There's not enough research about that, what that number should be. And bless them, the Washington advocates, I know some of these drafters of it, and they're former prosecutors who realize that the drug war is wrong. But it is a flaw. I still urge Washington voters to pass that initiative and worry about the nuances later. It can always be changed. But this issue is not just about cannabis, but America's real addiction, prescription pill abuse. There's not really a breathalyzer for OxyContin abuse or whatever, and you can't do that with cannabis really either. And the reason for this is that it stays in your blood for about a month after using in very small trace amounts, but it's only it's the same thing as kind of like a night out drinking where, you know, a couple of hours later, if you've used cannabis, eaten it, or used a vaporizer or smoked it, that, you know, you're not going to be under the effect, you're not going to be intoxicated anymore, for lack of a better word. So but you can't have a breathalyzer test. So it's a good question. We need to develop law enforcement sobriety tests that really test whether someone is able to drive or not, as opposed to a simple breathalyzer test as we do with alcohol.
What are the most abused drugs right now in this country and the most fatal?
By far, alcohol is the most dangerous and the most fatal drug. If you're talking about, like, acute, you know, alcohol-related violence or deaths or abuse, in other words, I'm leaving out nicotine is what I'm trying to say. We as a society have agreed that, you know, we want alcohol in our society. We tried banning it. It didn't work. It's embarrassing, these little amendments we have in our otherwise elegant constitution, when hysterical zealots tried to dictate what people could or could not do, especially something that they've wanted to do for millennia. You know, you just can't dictate. You have to have more respect, in my view, for responsible adult use. You can't pretend to be the crossing guards and the nannies for people and what they want to use. So we've accepted the relatively large cost associated with alcohol. Cannabis, I believe, the adverse costs, health care, et cetera, roadside accidents of legalization would be infinitesimal compared to alcohol. And to affect it even more on the negative side, or to bring the negative side down, just the tiniest portion of our $15 billion a year drug war budget, how about $1 billion towards real, honest education? Then I think we wouldn't worry so much about the negative.
Now tell me, Doug Fine, you're joining us from Silver City, New Mexico. Tell us about where you live there and also this goat herding business before we leave.
Oh, yeah. Well, people who are interested in that, too, can read Farewell, My Subaru, which was my previous book to this one we're discussing today. And it was detailed my bumpy road from East Coast suburbanite to solar-powered goat rancher, neo-rugged individualist out in the middle of nowhere, New Mexico, which is still how I live. The argument is that you can be sustainable and still have American sort of digital age comforts because, you know, I do have internet. It's just solar powered, you know. So that's my world when I'm not touring around, as I'm probably going to be, at least through the coming election, talking about the coming drug peace era.
Well, I certainly want to thank you. It's been a pleasure to have you on. We've been speaking with journalist and author Doug Fine. And, of course, we've been talking about his latest book, Too High to Fail, Cannabis and the New Green Economic Revolution. Thank you very much, Doug Fine, and the best to you.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
And our apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. We thank you for listening this hour. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction by Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary gives production assistance. Of course, we have free audio archives and MP3 downloads at our website, WLRN.org. Perhaps you didn't hear the whole program. Find author and book links at the Topical Currents webpage. Drop us a like so your friends can see us as well. Tomorrow's program is with Miami Herald writer Eleanor Brecker. She specializes in news obituaries of noteworthy South Floridians, as well as animal issues. Also, there's Linda Gastenheimer's Food and Dining, behind the scenes at the legendary Epicure Markets. We'll celebrate the coming of the Jewish New Year. And the calendar on this day, 1687, 325 years ago. The last of the Mayflower Pilgrims, John Alden, dies in Duxbury, Massachusetts. He sat on one of the Salem witch trial juries. And on this day in 1953, 59 years ago, wedding bells for Senator John F. Kennedy and Jacqueline Bouvier in Newport, Rhode Island. 2,000 attended the reception at Hammersmith Farm, where Jackie once spent her summers. One more while we fondly remember the Highwaymen. On this day in 2003, 9 years ago, the death of music legend Johnny Cash in Nashville, age 71. We leave with a thought from Jackie Kennedy Onassis, whose father, Black Jack, was a Playboy stockbroker. Quote from Jackie, "If you bungle raising your children, I don't think whatever else you do matters very much." This is Joseph Cooper. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation. From NPR News.
You're listening to